Hello, everybody, and a warm welcome to a brand new episode of The Joy of Logistics. And I'm very glad that you're taking the time out of your busy day and join us for another episode. And without spoiling too much, it's going to be epic. It's going to be epic. Quick note before we start, I'm really delighted by the amount of people that pre-registered today in order to be in the audience of this phenomenal podcast. We have 60 people, 60 that enlisted in today's podcast, which is absolutely mind-blowing. It's a record. And once again, I want to say a big thank you to each and everybody joining us today. And without further ado, I wanna step forward. And just in case, maybe you're a first time listener of The Joy of Logistics today, and maybe you're asking yourself, okay, Joy of Logistics, what's that? Who's this Christoph guy, by the way? Let me just briefly introduce myself. My name is Christoph. I'm the host and the founder of the Joy of Logistics podcast series. And I've been active in the logistics industry now for a decade, especially focused on air and ocean freight. And I created this podcast, specifically this channel, in order to provide the stage for out-of-the-box people, out-of-the-box companies, and also to share wisdom, share knowledge, as this is a purely educational channel. And of course, in case you're tuning in and that's also interesting to you, just make sure that you also share this information with friends, coworkers, colleagues, whatsoever, because I believe that we are each and everybody involved. It comes together to learn, and this is why we are coming together here as well. Today I have a phenomenal guest, as you've seen in the title. It's the Holistic Transportation Rethought. And I'm sure you probably wondered, okay, what is that even going to mean? I mean, are they going to reinvent the wheel? And let me tell you, no, but that's the only spoiler alert that I'm going to give you. There we go again. Yeah, it seems there is some technical issue, but this happens. So I don't know what you guys have been hearing so far, but again, a warm welcome to Dr. Klaus Rademacher, who is joining me today. So, another try. All good things are three, as we say out here in Germany. I hopefully fixed this issue. So yeah, where did you guys lose me? Klaus, are you there? Can you hear
me? I am here. I can hear you. I do not know how many other people are listening. I cannot see anyone else but you, but I hope that people can hear me and possibly see me. And
yes,
I'm ready to go.
Excellent. And as I can see, they are already active in the comment section in here. So everything good. I think we are back on track. Yeah, apologies for the inconvenience, but yeah, technologies, that's just how it is. But yeah, as I was alluding to earlier, Klaus, you're a multiple award winner. You've been busy all across the globe, basically. Of course, you have a high esteemed status when it comes down to mobility, you know, and maybe you can also give a swift introduction of who you are to the people, because I think you can do that way better than I could.
Certainly. Thank you for the introduction, Christoph. After such an introduction, I don't even know whether I have much to say. But anyway, my name is Klaus Rademacher. My background actually is in computer science. Back in the 1980s, so 40 years ago, I got a master's degree and graduated in computer science, got a PhD, went to school at the University of Karlsruhe in Germany, also at the University of Massachusetts, Boston, many, many years back. And then I've been in the industry, not in the logistics industry, but rather telecommunications for many, many years in different leading positions, seat positions. And for the last several years in my own small company, KRBE, I've been, I got very interested in mobility systems, transportations. Mm-hmm. I was asked to do a study, a survey on the holistic ecological assessment of transportation system, which I did, mm-hmm. which had quite some impact in the industry. And this is what I'm going to talk about today. What I'm otherwise doing is working in projects when there are clients who have specific projects for me to do calculations on ecological impact, CO2 emission impact, and things like that. But I also give presentations like this. I've been teaching a seminar at the KTH, the Royal Institute of Technology in Stockholm, Sweden. I've been doing some work in Austria as well. And today I'm really happy to be here, and thanks for having me, Christoph.
Fantastic. Absolutely. And once again, I'm very honored that you are taking your time, Klaus, to join us here. And I hope everybody in the audience has a pen and notebook ready, because I'm sure that there will be some amazing ideas and concepts being shared with all in here. So I think, yeah, let's dive right into it. And I think a good point, because obviously, you know, these days, no matter where you are in the world, you know, you hear just so much about, oh yeah, emissions and pollutions here, and electric vehicle here, and electric trucks over there, you know. And I'm sure, just like myself, regular people would or get awfully overwhelmed by the amount of information going on, and simply because they have no one to ask. And there is also this, the classic, so to speak, when it comes down to emission calculations. And maybe that's a good starting point for us today. What is your thoughts on the emission calculation basis, respectively on EVs for that matter?
Well, on EVs, now we're talking about propulsion energy or drive energy again. That's what electric vehicles usually are special about. And my perception on that is that looking at the drive energy, at the propulsion energy of the vehicle, is completely insufficient when it comes to judging, when it comes to assessing what the overall ecological mm-hmm. footprint of a particular system, transportation system is. But to go into that, I provided you with a few slides, Christoph, that mm-hmm. probably would be helpful if we can start them now, so I can get into the topic sure. right away. And just for the ongoing presentation, I want to make it a rather short presentation, just a few slides, and I'd be very happy if after my short presentation we can discuss some of the aspects that I will be talking about, or also any other aspect regarding logistics. Mm-hmm. And then I hopefully we'll have a really good discussion on this. Okay. Yes. Absolutely. This is the headline. This is the main title. I always claim we calculate wrong. We calculate completely wrong when we talk about emissions, traffic emissions in particular, or mobility emissions, because a holistic ecological assessment takes much, much more than just looking at the drive energy or propulsion energy. And mm-hmm. this is what we see on the next slide. If we look at transportation or mobility systems in general, and if you could just, yeah, right here, we see that there are four primary transportation systems. It's the railroad, it's the road, it's cars, it's aviation, mm-hmm. and it's shipping. These are the four main systems. Mm-hmm. And each of these systems require not only a vehicle and the drive energy or propulsion energy, it also requires a very specific infrastructure. And this infrastructure, right. and this is pretty much the ideas that I developed a couple of years back to come up with this matrix or table. The infrastructure mm-hmm. can always be subdivided into a node infrastructure, a path infrastructure, and a control infrastructure. All of the four systems need that and have that. The node infrastructure is where we start and terminate or end any kind of transportation process. We always start, when we go by train, we start in a station and the train stops in a station and we get off the train. And in an aircraft, it's the airports. And for shipping, it's the ports, it's the harbors. And for the road, this is where right. most people have difficulties when it comes to thinking about node infrastructure. Where is that? There is no specified there is no designated port for cars. No, there is not, but there's parking space. And every transportation mm-hmm. starts with a parked car and it ends with a parked car. And so the parking space, mm-hmm. no matter whether that is in a garage, whether it's on the street or whether it's in your private driveway, this is the node infrastructure for the road transport system. And then the very, very important is the path infrastructure. That is everything that we need between nodes. Because on land-based mm-hmm. transportations, and that's railway and road, we have to build this infrastructure. And that's railway networks and the infrastructure for electrification if we want to go with electric trains. And for mm-hmm. the road system, for the cars, we need streets, gas stations, and the charging infrastructure so we can keep going. And now the very interesting right. part is in aviation, the path infrastructure, it's air. It's nothing but air. Mm-hmm. We do not need anything but air between two airports. And the air is always there. It does not need to be built and there is no maintenance required. And to somewhat similar in shipping, especially when we are in the international oceans, the oceans are there. Mm-hmm. They do not need to be built and they do not need to be maintained by anything. Of course, if we Correct. Are on rivers or even canals, these have to be built, these have to be taken care of, they have to be maintained in order to be deep enough. But for the international sea shipping, the oceans are just there. So that's the path infrastructure. And then the last part, the control infrastructure, very important. Most people do not really think about that. Control infrastructure ensures that several participants in the same systems can provide transportation at the same time in a secure and controlled manner so that cars don't bump mm-hmm. into each other, that we have no accidents, that trains don't collide with each other. And that is the control infrastructure. That is in railways is it's the signal boxes, the signal systems, the switches on the road. It's the traffic lights, the traffic signs. In aviation, it's everything that has to do with air traffic control facilities. And in shipping, yes, there are some lighthouses, radio beacons. Sometimes we even have pilots in some waters and when ships operate in harbors and ports. So these pilots actually are part of the control infrastructure. But this understanding is really important when you want to have a holistic view on the system. And in order to determine the carbon dioxide emissions, it is, as I said, completely insufficient to only look at the operating energy. You have to take the whole system into consideration. And what we will see on the next slide is that in particular path infrastructure, but to some extent also node infrastructure, is very, very intense with regard to certain materials. This is just a collection of different photos. You see infrastructure, node infrastructure and path infrastructure. And I won't go into the details. You can all see that right away. We see train bridges and we see electrification and a parking garage. What we see here, or what we have to keep in mind, is we see enormous amounts of steel, of concrete with cement, very often a lot of copper when it comes to electrification and catenary wires, but we also see aluminum, and all these materials have a dramatic footprint when it comes to carbon dioxide, when it comes to CO2. That is what we have on the next slide. If you just go forward, please.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So here I give you just some numbers. The production of each one ton, for example, of steel generates 2 tons of carbon dioxide just in the coke plant and blast furnace. And just the railroad track, the rails that trains run on, for 1 kilometer of railroad track, we need 120 tons of steel. That's just the track. There is nothing, no other steel involved on the that might be needed for the slab track or what anything else. And a similar thing, if we are on a highway, 1 kilometer of guardrail on a highway is anywhere between 14 and 15 tons of steel and 2 tons carbon dioxide per ton of steel is quite impressive if you look at these numbers. Speaking about aluminum, it gets even worse. Aluminum, I have to admit that this, the number 8 to 10, is there is quite a range, and that depends on what is the carbon footprint of your power generation for electricity, because it's very electricity intense. But for 1 ton of aluminum, on average, on this planet, we have 8 to 10 tons of carbon dioxide that are emitted somewhere. Copper is 6 tons or even a little bit more. And once again, to give you an impression, that catenary wire I already talked about, which hangs above a railroad track, 1 kilometer, if the catenary wire, like it is usually in Germany or in Europe, it's about 120 square millimeters. And if you take 1 kilometer of that with a weight of copper, you need more than 1 ton of copper. And to produce 1 ton of copper from the copper ore, you emit more than 6 tons of carbon dioxide. And that does not even include the energy that is required for making a wire. It's just the poor metal. Cement, 1 ton of cement comes up with 1 ton of carbon dioxide. And depending on how much cement you have in the concrete, and you need a lot of concrete when you build roads, especially when it comes to building bridges or even tunnels for trains. We have, for 1 cubic meter, that's the measurement usually in concrete, we have anywhere between 250 and 400 kilograms of carbon dioxide. And so my point, my main message is that the carbon dioxide emissions that do not come from the propulsion energy, from the drive energy, they're far too large to be ignored. And that is what we always have to keep in mind. And of course, the question is, to what extent can we utilize the infrastructure that was once built? But we have some more information on that on the next slides.
Let's go there. Here we go. I hope this works.
Keep going. By the way, I just realized there was quite a mistake on that slide, because steel, of course, is spelled with double E and not with EA. But I guess you all realized that this was a mistake. So getting back to the railway path infrastructure, because at least in Germany and in many European countries, the railroads or taking the train is considered very eco-sensitive, is considered to be very eco-friendly. Mm-hmm. And that is not even true if you only look at the drive energy, but it becomes even less true if you look at what it takes to build the infrastructure. For 1 kilometer of high-speed double-track line, so that's two rails mm-hmm. next to each other, in one for each direction. So you need actually four lines of steel rails, but the double track high speed line requires almost 15,000 tons of gravel or sand for the substructure. And then on top of that, you have 241 tons of railed steel, as I just mentioned there. And if your train runs, or if the rails are laid on a so-called slab track, so that's a solid concrete layer where you put the rails on, you need almost 2,300 cubic meters of concrete and 133 tons of reinforcing steel in that slab track. And in case you have the more classical construction, where you have concrete sleepers on a bed of ballast, so ballast is just another kind of gravel, you need more than 7,000 tons of ballast, 380 cubic meters of concrete, that's for the concrete sleepers, and then 39 tons of steel and other iron parts to fix the rails on the sleepers and all that. So this means, if you just look at the CO2 emissions from the production of this material, that we're close to 1,600 tons of carbon dioxide per kilometer on a slab track, and about half of that, or a little more than half of that, if you go with concrete sleepers and ballast. So these are enormous numbers. I mean, 1 ton is 1,000 kilograms. So 1,000 tons of CO2 is 1 million kilograms, and that has to be put into relationship to the traffic that we have, the traffic volume. And it gets even worse. I won't read all this to you. You can look this up, because this is all online. But looking at concrete bridges, if you look at the numbers here, 1 kilometer of steel concrete bridge, and of course these are average numbers, average values, because every bridge is different and every tunnel is different. Mm-hmm. But we're talking for 1 kilometer, usually thousands of tons of steels, tens of thousands cubic meters of concrete, and the same amount of excavated material. And that is also very CO2 intensive, because it has to be digged out, has to be excavated, put away, at least stored during the construction, possibly brought back for filling things up. So there's a lot of handling of this material. And railroad tunnels are very similar, to more than 2,000 tons of steel. And you see the numbers here. One of the first railroad tracks I looked at is the railroad line Cologne-Frankfurt. That's about 170 kilometers of railroad track in Frankfurt. Has been operational now for a little less than 20 years, I'd say. And there are 47 kilometers of tunnel in 30 tunnel structures on this track. So 47 kilometers out of the 170 kilometers are tunnels. And you look at the tunnels that are here, that I just mentioned. Dozens of bridges spanning the valleys. There was 6-year construction times. There were up to 15,000 workers working on that track simultaneously. And all of them need to get to the construction site, and they need to get back home at least at the weekends. And so all of that needs to be taken into consideration when it comes to building a railroad track. And we can definitely say that several million tons of carbon dioxide were emitted before the first train could run. And that does not even include the train stations that were specially built for this track.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
So please go on.
crazy numbers, and big thank you, by the way, for sharing those. And this is quite remarkable to actually see them the way they are, you know, because as you already alluded to, Klaus, those are all things that no one is talking about whenever you're reading in a newspaper, journal, whatsoever. No one is sharing these numbers and taking them into consideration. So that's mm-hmm. indeed a very big one. Mm-hmm. And also from the audience, John is sharing a comment that I just want to put up with. John, thank you so much for adding. John says, might I add another key component to this require components? Personal. We humans require our personal infrastructure to operate these systems. And that's absolutely very good.
Absolutely. I have nothing to add to that. I just mentioned here on this slide that personnel, 15,000 people working on this track simultaneously. I mean, not forever, but it was built for 6 years, and that needs to, they all have to get there somehow. Yes. But so this is my idea is to make sure that people understand what holistic thinking actually means, and that we have to take far more things into account than what we usually do. Okay, but let's go to the next slide, because I want to have, this was a very good remark, and I want to have more time for these comments. And
absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. Let me pull this up here. There we go.
So yeah, what I'm saying is thinking mobility differently means that we have to really, we have to reshape our ideas about mobility. For example, also what is not really helpful is the form of public transportation as it is used today, or as it is provided today. I mean, in very, very large city, it certainly makes sense to have subway trains running. But in many, many other cities, if you look throughout the day, most buses, trains, subway trains, or streetcars, most of the time they are not even 20 to 30% filled. They simply do not have the load that would be required to run them efficiently. And we have to think much, much more about mobility as a service platforms that provides mobility to me when I need it, and not that I have to own my own car, that which is sitting in my driveway for 23 hours on average each day, and only being used for 1 hour. And when I use it, in most European countries, it's only occupied on average by 1.5 persons. And that is such an inefficient use of individual mobility of cars. So mobility as a service platforms are very, very important. We have to intensify research on environmentally friendly fuels. Very, very important, because just claiming that electricity or electrically operated trains are ecologically good doesn't help us. I mean, you can't negotiate or trade with physics or chemistry. So you really have to look at the background, at the physical and at the chemical things that are happening there. And just claiming something doesn't change the reality. Yeah. And we have to replace inefficiently used combustion engines with, equally inefficiently used electric engines does not help the climate. That is what is happening in many, many countries. They subsidize electric vehicles, but they do not go down to the real issue that these vehicles, the average vehicle, has a footprint of 8 tons of carbon dioxide before it's yours. That's just the production value of an average vehicle, and an electric vehicle has a much higher CO2 footprint, because the electric batteries have a very, very bad footprint. Still, we're talking 6 to 10 kilograms per kilowatt hour of battery. And so a large battery, 100 kilowatt hour, for example, is 6 to 10 tons of carbon dioxide, which has to be added to the numbers that I already mentioned before. And at least in Germany, we have the situation that even when you run electrically, the average kilowatt hour in Germany has a carbon footprint of about 500 grams CO2. So that is one of the worst in Europe. I know that other countries are much, much better. But this really, once again, shows that it is completely wrong just to change the drive energy, because that doesn't really help to change the system and to make sure that it's being used in a much more efficient way.
And I think a point that's also oftentimes critically underestimated is also, especially talking about EVs and batteries that you already alluded to, Klaus, the question is also, hey, okay, you can drive the car or the truck or whatever it might be driven by electricity, but what happens once the lifetime of the battery is over, once the battery has to be replaced, for instance, right? Nobody's talking about that either.
We don't know that yet, frankly, because that is something where there is a lot of guessing around. We will learn it the hard way. That's one thing that's for sure. But right now, there is such a hype about electric mobility, especially when it comes to individually used cars, that it is very, very difficult to convince people that they should rethink this. I mean, this is something that is one of my personal goals, to get more facts and figures into the discussion, and try to get rid of ideology and emotions. And that is something that I'm seeing in most parts where I've been working. And with most projects, the discussion is very, very emotional. And we're talking about a topic which is very, very down to physics and to some extent chemistry. So it's natural science. It's math and natural science. And physics doesn't care about our feelings or our emotions. So we have to get down to the numbers. That is what I'm advertising. Yeah. Okay, let's go to the next slide.
Yeah, absolutely. But before I move, I have a quick comment from the audience I want to pull up real quick. Carlo Chirici, I hope I pronounced this correctly, Carlo. Another important component to internalize to be holistic air/water pollution, noise pollution, space occupied by roads, rails, congestion, etc. So I think he's pointing out those external effects.
Yeah, very good, Carlo. I can say that you're absolutely right. There is much more than just carbon dioxide. I focused my research on carbon dioxide and then extended it beyond that. And of course, space is an issue. Noise pollution, vibrations are an issue with regard to that. Water, of course. I have not really looked at water into detail, but of course, battery production in particular is very, very water intense as well. And there are other aspects than just these ecological. There are also economical aspects, and then there are aspects of reliability, of resiliency, and so on and so on. So if you look at the survey that I wrote, which has been published about 2 years ago, you will see that quite some of these aspects that you just mentioned and some more, they are at least briefly addressed in that. And I have also written several articles which were published in newspapers or in electronic media that sometimes address specific parts of what you just mentioned. But for today, I thought I focus on the CO2 topic, because we simply do not have sufficient time to discuss everything that is important. But you're absolutely right that this is a holistic thinking is a very broad field.
Excellent. And I just see there are just the comments popping up, and I just got to bring in those two more. John, again, the general idea is that most battery packs used in the EV market can't be recycled and must be disposed of in landfills.
Yeah, I have nothing to add to that. There will be a lot of surprises to many, many people once we have the first generation of cars that are beyond their lifetime of their batteries. That is it's also people, sometimes they have to learn it the hard way. Depending on where you are, I mean, in California, I spend a lot of time in California because I've been working there as well in my previous life. previous professional life. And in California, for example, you don't have, usually you don't have to deal with cold winters and temperatures which are significantly below 15 centigrade, for example, which is around 60 Fahrenheit. And what people, and this is why Tesla in California is wonderful. But if you take that to Germany, you will realize when you have temperatures around 32 Fahrenheit, zero, between 0 and 5 centigrade, that the battery power it decreases drastically just because of the temperature. That is really something that many people, they don't know, they don't want to know, and they find out when they have their EV car. Okay.
Okay. Yeah. Next one. Next slide. So there we go.
Okay. Here we are. What else is important? Oh, here we are. This is what what was just mentioned. We have other ecological aspects, as I said, land consumption, noise, vibrations, etc. Aspects of reliability, stability, fail safety, extremely important, resilience, fault tolerance, and all of it. And then economic aspects. That is something which is very often completely ignored. And at least in many European countries, we have the situation that the federal governments or the European Union, they provide a lot of money for what they call a mobility shift or transportation shift towards electric mobility. As someone paying taxes and someone using mobility, I come up with a question: what does mobility actually cost if the calculations are done honestly and correctly? And what I said before, you have to look at this matrix again, at this slide at the very beginning, where you have the path infrastructure, the node infrastructure, the control infrastructure, plus the vehicle, plus the drive energy. You can calculate for costs of all of that, and then you have to divide that by the transportation volume, the performance, transportation performance. That is usually, if you're talking transportation of people, we're speaking of PKM, person kilometer, or people kilometers. So that's one person for 1 kilometer. And if we're talking of freight and goods, we're talking ton kilometers, TKM. And you have to get the numbers right. You have to do the calculations honestly and correctly. And then you come up with a price tag. And then you can ask the question, who pays? Are the costs allocated to the originator? So, for example, most people in Europe take it for granted that the infrastructure for railway systems, they are provided by the government. They expect that, but that does not make them free. I mean, I spoke about the carbon dioxide emissions that that originate from these railroads, but they also cost tens of billions of euros. And that is, someone has to pay for that. So it's usually taxpayers' money. And then, of course, a government can have a policy stating we want to do that. But I think it would be really fair to the citizens of the government if it becomes transparent and then apparent how much we actually spend and with how much money do we subsidize each ton kilometer of railroad transportation or each person kilometer of train driving by the people, train riding by the people. Yeah. So this is the further ecological aspects plus the economic aspects that need to be taken into account when you speak of holistically thinking on mobility, about mobility.
Okay. Fantastic. And I guess the next slide.
Yep. We're almost done. Yeah.
We're
very good. Yeah. My point is, the conclusion is, and I selected, I think, these 10 slides out of more than 100 that I already have. And I have them in the background in case there are very specific questions. But the overall conclusion, the message that I really want to get through today is that fact-based solutions based on scientific facts and engineering possibilities, they urgently must gain influence. We also know that mobility and transportation needs will grow, and thus it means we do need intelligent solutions and not bans. It does not help to ban systems just because of ideological reasons. And I'm also fully aware we cannot go on like we did before. I mean, more of the same is not possible. I just mentioned I've been spending quite some time in the Silicon Valley working there. And whoever knows that 101 from San Francisco Airport down all the way to San Jose is a nightmare. But once again, we're using it completely inefficiently because in Russia, every single car only has one person in it. And that is what makes the MIV, the motorized individual traffic, or MIT, so inefficient. And even the carpool lanes that have been invented in California, as far as I know, even if they force you to put two or three people in a car, that does not help. But as long as everyone is kind of forced first to purchase a car and buy a car, and then use it for 15 minutes or half an hour to go to work, and then put it on a parking lot, and then it sits there for 10 hours, and then you use it again for 30 minutes to go back home, and then it sits there again for 10 hours. That is a completely inefficient use of the resources. And today, not 20 years ago and not 30 years ago, but today we have much, much smarter ways of utilizing the resources. And that is what we absolutely have to get into our mobility systems.
And if I another, may...
If okay, I, if I just... Yeah, go ahead, Christoph, please. I'm okay. Talking too much.
You're good. You're good. If I just want to add, because... especially on the second point here, we need intelligent solution, not bans. And that's something that sparked my eye because I read earlier this year that the Californian committee, they are now voting for or even ruling for banning all combustion powered trucks out of the ports of out of the Californian ports, which is essentially Los Angeles, Long Beach, and also Oakland. Although LA or the port of LA is much bigger, yet no one is there to answer the question. Hey, okay, how is this transportation need then replaced? Because at the end of the day, LA is such a busy port with so many containers coming in and going out. At the end of the day, some sort of truck or vehicle, I just call it vehicle right now, we'll have to move it at the end of the day. And that's oftentimes just fully ignored. And I think this has also the potential to really backfire to each and everybody involved, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep, absolutely. Maybe you can go into that a little bit more in detail in the discussion. I have just two more statements here. And the third one is, what I found out in my studies and what I came up in the sort of economy and ecology are not mutually exclusive. This is what many people claim. They say, oh, when something is ecological, of course it is more expensive and of course it has to be subsidized and so on. This is not true. This is absolutely not true. So we can build systems that are economically viable and are much, much more ecological than what we have today. And then my last statement, and I love this the most, actually, physics, chemistry, mathematics, and all natural sciences, they do not care whether they're understood or not. And they don't care about majority opinions. They're valid for those who do not understand them as well. That is very, very important because I'm giving lectures on this. And sometimes when I was talking to students in a class at a local university or regional university here in sustainability management, I keep telling them these things in more detail and do a little bit more of the mathematical the calculations and the physical formulas about mobility. And then they say, but don't the politicians have to do what the majority of the people want? And I say, well, think about that. There are certain things where it is completely unimportant what people want. We cannot change physics or chemistry by a majority vote in our parliament. Even the non-democratic societies cannot change that. So this is any kind of mobility is applied physics, full stop. I have nothing to add to that. Any kind of mobility is applied physics. And anything that happens in the atmosphere is chemistry and physics. It's atmospheric chemistry and it's atmospheric physics. And we have to live with that. And if we don't like it, we have to leave the planet. So for example, the gravitational constant, which is very important when it comes to determining the amount of energy that is required for certain transportation processes. If we don't like the gravitational constant, G, 9.81 in on our planet, we have to go somewhere else. I recommend Moon or Mars. It's much lower there. But on this planet, we cannot change it. And we have to live with it. And that is the case with many things. And that is something that I sense people don't like to understand or don't want to understand, or all combination of both. And that is very, very often ignored. That is not harmful. Mm-hmm. That is not helpful. It's very harmful. I'm sorry. Okay.
Okay. Next slide.
I think we're pretty much through already. I think the next one, keep going. Yeah. Yes. This is the English version of the study, of the survey that I already mentioned. There also is a German version, which looks much, much nicer. The original study is available at the Friedrich Naumann Foundation. They are the ones who commissioned the study, and they asked me to write it. The English version is available on my website, and all the links are here, and you find many other topics in German and in English under the links that are provided here, and you find my personal information. But that is pretty much what I wanted to show with you, wanted to share with you using the slides. And I'm very happy to discuss with you now. If you have any other specific questions, I might have a slide as a backup slide in the background, mm-hmm. and then I can still provide that.
Fantastic. And first of all, I want to say very, 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 very big thank you, Klaus, for sharing this. Amazing. This is just mind-blowing. And as I was already alluding to, the audience is also going crazy with the comments, which is really amazing to see. And I just want to pull up a few points here. Very interestingly, for instance, Carl, he asked, why Germany stopped nuclear production, by far the lowest CO2 emission by kilowatt hours produced. As you say, this is physics and maths.
Yes, you are absolutely right. I have nothing to say that the reason why they did it, I can only speculate about that. Once again, we're talking about ideology and not about physics and mm-hmm. math. They did not ask me, and personally,
which is a mistake.
I think I wouldn't go that far. Personally, I think it's a signal into the complete wrong direction, but it clearly shows how ideological politics is. But this question has to be addressed to our Secretary of Economics and Energy, Dr. Robert Habeck.
Okay. Maybe I have a chance and get him also on the show, maybe. But yeah, that's a whole different topic here. I also wanna put here real quick, Bill Robinson. Thank you so much for your comment, by the way. Thank you for engaging this much in the comment section. Thank you. Bill said California is not green. They generate hydro with fossil fuels. Klaus is 100% correct. We lose 20 to 30% life in winter in Canada with EVs.
Yep. Thank you for reassuring me of that. Canada is similar to Germany. Then, in general, with regard to California, I mean, green is one of the most misused terms. Same as with sustainability. So, what is green? What is sustainable? What is ecologically? What is carbon neutral? And so on and so on. There are lots of terms which are being used all over, and very, very difficult to prove or to counterprove. What I can say is I've spent quite some time in California. Their footprint compared, you always have to compare it to the performance, the traffic performance in particular. And the mm-hmm. footprint is in California is definitely much, much better than mm-hmm. Compared to Germany.
Mm-hmm. And just connecting the dots with Canada and EVs, that's an article I read. I shared that also prior to the show with you, Klaus. Because as we know, Canada has very, well, just a few very dense populated places and a lot of like almost, it's just land, it's just nature. Yet it was towards the end of last year when I first read it, especially the provinces like Alberta, Saskatchewan, etc., those huge trains that are transporting the cargo from A to B. There was a study thinking about turning all this railroad into electrified railroad, where I was thinking, like, good gosh, please no. I mean, where is the electricity coming from? Especially taking into consideration that the cargo trains in North America are by far heavier and larger than what they are in Europe. Most of the time they are propelled by diesel engines. So I was just wondering, how on earth would you come up with something like that?
Yep, you're right. I looked at that. I mean, this was a long study and survey. I couldn't read it completely. What I was puzzled most is that they were thinking of electrifying it catenary free, as they say. So that means there is no electrification, because as I said before, the electrification of a railroad line, it's not only the catenary wire of copper. You need tons of steel to make sure that the catenary wire is held in the place where it is. And about every 65 meters, you need a post, or then you need lots of weights and counterweights, because there are enormous forces are on these catenary wires, especially when trains are going underneath very fast. So there is a lot of that, and this is why the electrification of a railroad line, depending where you are in a tunnel, for some reason it is less CO2 extensive than outside of a tunnel. I will explain in a moment why that is the case, but it easily is close to 200 tons of carbon dioxide just for the materials for 1 kilometer of a double track railroad line. Now, why is it less intense in a tunnel? Because you do not need the posts every 65 meters. In a tunnel, you have the tunnel shell, which is of concrete, and there are so-called suspension columns that can be mounted directly to the ceiling of the tunnel shell. And so you don't have to place posts every 65 meters, because the posts, they're either of steel again, or they're of concrete. But because of the massive weights and forces that are on these posts, they need a very large or a very sturdy and stable concrete foundation again. So once again, we have the same materials, steel and concrete. And this is what makes infrastructure so carbon dioxide intense. And this is what many, many people do not understand. And many who do understand that, they simply ignore it, because for the last decades they've been telling the people, the population, something different, and this is it's simply incorrect.
Fantastic. Appreciate the deep dive into that topic as well, Klaus. Thank you so much. Charles also wrote a fantastic comment here. I want to bring this up real quick. Thank you so much for the comment, everybody. Highly appreciated. And Charles is asking, what do you think about CO2 calculators that we now have in the market? I'm specifically thinking about cargo CO2 calculators. I pass this question directly on to Klaus.
Okay, and I answer with one question. How much time do we have, Christoph? Now, this is... let me say something. These CO2... I have not seen a CO2 calculator that is at least, I would say, to 80%, not to speak of 90%, taking into account what needs to be taken into account. That is the first thing. So, of course, it is very simple. It is very, very easy with regard to the drive energy. But when it comes to infrastructure, the important thing is, if I have a 100-kilometer rail line, first question is, how long is that good for? How long will it last? How long will I have trains on it? How many trains will there be? If we look at cargo, what is the efficiency with regard to utilization of a train? They are not always full. Very often, you have full trains going into one direction and the empty trains go back. Then we have to look at, when it comes to cargo, what is actually the ratio of payload versus the complete mass that needs to be moved? This is, once again, an issue when we're speaking of electric movement and batteries. I can give you one example in general. Now I'm going back to the car. In a car, if you have a large tank in the car for a certain amount, let's assume you have a tank, and to make it easy, I'm sticking with metric numbers. You have 50 kilograms of gasoline in the car. 50 kilograms is a little bit more than 60 liters. And 60 liters are around 15 gallons, just very, very roughly. But speaking of that, so you burn this fuel, and the tank gets empty, and then you have 50 kilograms less mass that needs to be transported. If you run on batteries for the same amount of battery power, you easily have a battery between 500 and 750 kilograms. So we're talking much, much more, 50 kilograms compared to 500, 750. So we're talking 10 to 15 times as much mass. But when the battery is getting empty, and before you recharge it, it still has the same weight while the tank was empty. And I mean, that is even more important in an aircraft where they burn hundreds, up to 100 tons or tens of tons of fuel, or also in large diesel engines. Well, the fuel is being burnt, it's gone, and you don't have to transport it. But with electric vehicles, the tank for the electricity remains the same weight and always has to be moved. And weight is important. Now, when we're speaking of a train that is thousands of tons, of course, the battery weight of half a ton is not so important, but on a truck or in a car, this is important. Mm-hmm. I do not see any in the near future, I do not see any decent cargo trains that are ready to transport thousands of tons of goods to be operated on batteries. It simply does not make sense. I do not see that. And I would be very surprised if we see any reasonable development in that, because we have the situation that with the lithium ion accumulators, the lithium ion batteries we are using. Now, this is a deep dive a little bit into chemistry. Maybe there is someone with a chemical background in the background. With lithium, we are already using the lightest metal that we have on this planet. I mean, if you look into the table of our system of different elements, lithium is number three. It's the lightest metal that we have. And at the same time, lithium has the advantage that it has the best chemical electrical relationship. It has a so you compare this to an hydrogen anode, and so we have a -3.04 volts of electrical energy in lithium, which we do not have in any other element on our table of elements. So lithium is pretty good, but it's the lightest already. So how should it become much lighter at the batteries? That's once again, this is not about making, oh, I wish we had it. It's looking into your chemistry book.
I like that. I like that very much. So yeah. Thank you. Thank you for sharing. And that's indeed a very interesting thing that you were referring to, Klaus, because what I also read occasionally is that even rather large container vessels are also being pioneered as becoming fully EV, where I'm thinking like, okay, where are you going to load those? I mean, you know, that's just, or charge, better to say, charge your batteries. It's just nonsense. You know, it just won't work out. And well, I'm neither a physics nor chemistry professor to actually judge that, but just when I think about it, just doesn't make sense to in my opinion. Yeah. You know,
we have to be a little bit careful with the term EV, electric vehicle, because many things can be done. Frankly, large ships, especially cruise ships these days, very often they run on electricity. They have electric engines. They have electric azipods, as they're called, not typical propellers, but the electricity is generated from diesel fuel on the ship. So technically, these all run on electricity. But mm-hmm. of course, the electricity is not in a battery. The electricity is produced on the ship. And the same thing can be done. We have that as well. If you look at nuclear vessels, especially nuclear submarines, you can have a nuclear, you can use nuclear energy and then drive or operate a ship on that. So the term EV has to be looked at, where does the electricity come from? And here I totally agree with you, Christoph, that I do not see anything in the, not during my lifetime, Frank, I'm 61 years old, so you can think of whatever my remaining lifetime will be. I do not foresee anything where we will have battery powers capable of operating such large equipment. Another thing is, I mean, this is another hype topic, and I just want to briefly mention it because I'm also very concerned and very worried about the hype on hydrogen. I don't know whether you want to go into that. Maybe there are other topics that you want to discuss, but I'm personally extremely worried on the hype that we currently see around hydrogen. I'm not saying hydrogen is generally bad, not saying that at all, but I'm usually become very skeptical when you start putting colors, like we have green electricity and blue electricity and black and brown electricity. And now, at least in Germany and in Europe, they're putting all kinds of colors around hydrogen. And unfortunately, a hydrogen molecule does not know what color it has. And this is why I'm very, very skeptical with regard to these kind of coloring things. That's good for the arts class, but not for the mechanical engineering class when it comes about electricity or any kind of other energy for moving things around.
It's actually great that you're touching base on that, Klaus, because that's indeed one of the questions that I have, because whether it's obviously hydrogen or any derivatives like ammonia, or then you also read a lot about methanol as the potential energies for the future in whatever color. I think for the regular Joe, or for you know, someone who doesn't study this and just isn't so much into this field, what are your thoughts on that? Do you think there is anything that could become the energy fuel juice of the future? Or maybe it really will be some of the e-fuels, or like how are they called? Like sustainable fuels. What's your take on that? I'm curious.
Mm-hmm. Yes, thank you, Christoph. I don't know how easy it would be or how complex it is to allow me to share another slide with you, which I have it open here on my laptop already. If that is easy, I could certainly do that, because I do have one slide on hydrogen, and I could if that is easy to do. Otherwise, I will just explain it, and it's up to you whether I can do that or whether I should not do that and just talk about it. I can talk about it as well. You will understand what I'm saying, because the slide has only some text on it.
Okay. If you want to show it, send it over to me via email.
That would take too long. Now, let me just talk about it. First of all, hydrogen. It has several advantages. It's not self-igniting. It is non-oxidizing. It's non-explosive. It's non-toxic. It's non-corrosive. So all of these are really this is good about hydrogen. Not everything is bad. Yeah, but now we come using it for fuel. Hydrogen is a gas, and it has a boiling point of -252.77 degrees centigrade, -252. So under normal conditions, 20 centigrade or 68 Fahrenheit, and the regular pressure in the atmosphere, which is 1,013 millibars or hectopascal, from there it has to be cooled down to -253 centigrade to become liquid. Important aspect. The other possibility of making hydrogen gas liquid is putting enormous pressure on it. We're talking 700 bar 700 bar. How much is that? I don't know. If you have a pressure cooker in your kitchen and you sometimes use a pressure cooker, you have 1.5 bar in the pressure cooker. Here we're talking 700 bar. All that is technically possible. I'm not saying it cannot be done. It's just it requires a lot of effort and a lot of effort to make that safe. So that is one thing. In order to use it as a source of energy, and once again, I'm still talking about elemental hydrogen, H2. Dealing with it is technically challenging because the high pressure or the low temperatures, they have to be maintained. I mean, all that can be done. And then we have to consider, many people say that hydrogen has the highest energy density of all elements. Once again, this is a correct statement, but this is a statement that looks at the relationship between weight and energy. So hydrogen has the largest, or related to its mass, it is the most, it's the element with the most energy inside. And so the mass-related energy density is enormous. It's the density is higher than any other element has, but the volume-related energy is extremely low because hydrogen is so light. And I already mentioned, so even if you with a pressure of 700 bars in 1 cubic meters, you only store 40 kilograms of hydrogen. So 1 cubic meter, it's 40 kilograms of hydrogen. And 1 kilogram of hydrogen we're talking 4.8 megajoule, 4.8 megajoule per kilogram. That is the energy density of hydrogen. And so we only have 40 kilograms in 1 cubic meter. If we compare that to kerosene, for example, for aircraft, in 1 kilogram, we have 31 megajoules. So that is a factor of 7, pretty much. So 1 kilogram of kerosene is 7 times more energy intense than 1 kilogram of hydrogen, although the hydrogen is already compressed to 700 bars. And this is what makes hydrogen very, very difficult to handle. And the other thing is, I mentioned that before, we have lots of hydrogen on this planet, but it is all, it's not elemental. And we need it elemental. So it's in water, it's in water vapor, it's in ice, all that has enormous amounts of hydrogen. But the energy calculations, the energy relationship is very poor. So what you can do is from water through electrolysis, you can get to elemental hydrogen, but you lose about 60% of the energy in the electrolysis process. Wow, so crazy. if we put in 100 units of energy into an electrolysis equipment, only 40 units of the energy will be available in the hydrogen afterwards. And then we still have to deal with all the technical issues that I already mentioned. So this is why I'm personally skeptical when it comes to elemental hydrogen. And of course, there are, and also, what I mean, Germany is now, our minister or the secretaries are traveling the world to find countries where they could produce the hydrogen for the German energy market, because we do not want to use the gas anymore. And then there are other forms of storing that or intermediate chemical products. Usually, all these calculations do not become better, they become worse. You know, because in the end, you have to look at the laws of thermodynamics, and you have to look at chemical reactions and what are exothermal and endothermal processes. And there is no way around that. We're back at the science level again. So that was a longer side path to hydrogen that I originally anticipated, but I hope that helps you a little bit in understanding why I am personally skeptical about it.
Absolutely. And there is also great question that I want to move on the screen real quick. John is asking, what's your opinion on LPG powered container ships? And that's a great question because we've seen, talking especially about the big container ships, more and more container lines are either actively buying a fully LPG powered or just playing around with it, so to speak, and intending to buy some of those. So that's a great question.
John, before I answer this, I want to make sure that I really understand LPG. I'm very familiar with the term LNG. That's liquefied natural gas. So LPG, what is that exactly? What are we talking here? I want to make sure that I understand the question before I start talking about it.
I think that
liquefied.
It is. Wait, let me pull this up real quick. Yeah, liquefied petroleum gas.
That's that's means. Pretty much the same. So what we're talking here is liquefied natural gas or also petroleum gas. This is usually methane, CH4. It's and you liquefy that. Yes, as gas has a much better carbon footprint than diesel, or in particular marine diesel or heavy oil. It does make sense. That's first point. The footprint is lower. What is important, though, and what has to be taken into consideration is, do we actually have this LPG or LNG available wherever we need it? A couple of years back, the cruise industry in Europe came up with the first LNG ship, and they were making lots of advertisements. Oh, if you go on this ship, this is far more environmentally friendly than any other ship that has ever been built before. And so what they did not tell the people that wherever this cruise ship was actually going, at the ports, there was simply no infrastructure for LNG. And so it turned out that pretty much wherever the cruise ship went, like 20 or 30 miles back, just out of sight, it was followed by a tanker providing LNG to the ship to make sure that it could be refueled where it had to be refueled. And that, of course, from a holistic perspective, that makes the whole thing less environmentally friendly than what they advertised. So this is what we're talking new technology, if we're talking new systems to provide propulsion to ships or to aircraft, we always have to take into consideration that it usually takes a certain amount of infrastructure to make that possible. And of course, building the infrastructure is something from a holistic point of view that needs to be put into the equation correctly. And it makes it a little bit more complicated, but nevertheless, if you ignore that, you're calculating wrong. And we're back to the title of my presentation.
So we come back full circle, so to speak.
No, my point is, I'm not saying this is bad, but where are we going to use it? Where are they being refueled? How does the LPG get there? Is it, all that is part of the holistic calculation, and it cannot and must not be ignored.
I mean, to answer that question, based on what I know, the shipping lines, they are intending to build somewhat like a very big gas station for vessels. I just put it like this, in Rotterdam, close to the Suez Canal. And I believe it was in Singapore, if I recall this correctly. So on those three very crucial points and ports where obviously many, many vessels are crossing, they are going to, or intend to build that up. As far as I know, it is not yet online.
Yeah, but still, when you have a port where the fuel is, you need the refineries. If it's liquefied petroleum gas, it starts with crude oil. It starts with gas. Where does the gas come from? How does it get there? Then when it's operated, run through the refinery and being liquefied and pumped into the ship. Yes, we have that. But the holistic calculation needs to take into consideration more. Then the question is, if this ship, you just mentioned three ports like Singapore, close to the Suez mm-hmm. Canal and Rotterdam, what is about the ships that go through the Panama Canal and they go to Asia there? Can they run from Rotterdam through the Panama Canal to all the way to Singapore with different stops that they have without being refueled? Would that be sufficient? Or are there certain, if they go, let's say, around South America for some other reason, they also need to be able to bunker marine oil or marine diesel or heavy fuel or whatever they're burning? Can the engines run on the same? Can the same engines run on different fuels without too much changing in between? How much technology do they need on the ship in order to be able to operate the engines and all of these different things? These are the questions that need to be answered. What I can assure is they all can be answered, but it mm-hmm. requires a lot of knowledge and it requires a methodological understanding of what has to be considered, and then it has to be calculated. But this mm-hmm. is the kind of work I'm doing for customers when they ask me to do certain calculations. I mean, this is the project work that I do. With the methodological knowledge and the methodological concepts that I have developed for this holistic thinking, with the appropriate information, I will be able to provide you with such calculations in more detail.
So maybe you soon have a new client. You know, if there is somebody from a shipping line listening, they're like, okay, yeah, that's the go-to guy. You know, I take a little bit of credit on that. No, jokes aside. As we are approaching to our limit already, dear Klaus, maybe one last question that has been on my mind, because obviously we are also reading a lot about, you know, whether it's those CII thing, the European Carbon Border Tax, whatnot. And of course, I don't want to go too much into it from a political and economical perspective. But I was thinking, because at the end of the day, all of those types that I just shared or mentioned, at the end of the day, there are just CO2 taxes in one way or another. What's your thought in general on CO2 taxes, and do you think that that's something for the future that we are going to see as something mandatory?
Well, I'm afraid we're seeing them already. I'm one of the few things I'm really confident about is they will remain. They will not go away again. How sensible this is, first of all, there are two very important aspects. CO2 emissions do not stop at national borders. This mm-hmm. planet only has one atmosphere. And from a chemical point of view, CO2 molecules that are emitted into the atmosphere, as long as they stay there, I mean, some are absorbed by the oceans and so on, but the average time that a single CO2 molecule that stays in the atmosphere stays there is about 100 years. And mm-hmm. for that reason, and it's active as a warming element for 100 years. And with that being said, It absolutely does not make sense to come up with any kind of national legislation mm-hmm. with regard to that. Because there, as long as there is the possibility that countries will not follow that, business will be moved to these countries. I'm not saying that from an environmental point of view, this is correct and that this is something that we should achieve, but I'm mm-hmm. fully aware of the fact that this will happen. So that the first important aspect is, if this is the political solution of choice, it has to be done internationally. Everything else mm-hmm. is simply going to fail. That's point one. And the second thing is that I see here, for example, in Germany, we've just had the situation that the law has been passed that as of next year, the carbon dioxide tax, for example, on fuel that we put into our tanks at the gas station, mm-hmm. this tax will go up again. And that is, this is where I'm saying we're talking ideology here again, because once again, from a chemical point of view, there is absolutely no differentiation or distinction between a CO2 molecule that comes from the exhaust pipe of my car compared to a CO2 molecule that comes from the production of concrete in Indonesia or the Philippines or anywhere else in the world, or a CO2 molecule that emits from the production of steel somewhere in the world. So politicians like to do that because they follow ideological thoughts and they try to get things into a certain direction. But if we're talking about a CO2 tax, we should keep in mind that there are many, many, many sources of CO2. Mm-hmm. By the way, including all of us, with every breath we take, we produce CO2.
Right.
Not a topic to discuss in more detail right now, but I just like to remind people of that, because I very often have discussions where people say we have to stop producing CO2 by 2040, the latest, completely. And I said, okay, then you have to stop breathing. I'm very sorry, but you have to stop breathing if you want to stop emitting CO2 by 2040 completely. Once again, this is just, it clearly, this is evidence for a lack of understanding what we actually have. But my point is, when it comes to the CO2 that we emit by anything that we do other than breathing, that's either producing steel or producing concrete or burning fuels, fossil fuels, all this CO2 has the same effect in the atmosphere. And so it does not make sense to tax one form of CO2 higher than others. Yeah, that is my point. And this is a direct derivative of the holistic thinking. I may say this at the end. I think that right now one of our the most important subject for the future is to find sustainable fuels that do not pollute the air with more CO2. And once we have done that, shipping and flying will be the most sustainable ways of transportation, because they do not need the land infrastructure that streets and rails and trains need. That is something that I try to make people understand, and it's not something that will change tomorrow or in 5 years, but we're talking long term. When I say that CO2 stays in the atmosphere for about 100 years or even a little bit longer, we have to expand our horizon far beyond the next 3 or 5 years of what politicians usually think when they think of election campaigns. These are issues that need to be dealt with far more foresight than what is happening right now.
Right. Fantastic. And that's an amazing share that you just provided, Klaus. Thank you for that. And maybe, as you already mentioned, planes, maybe also a quick question on that. You answered that a little bit, but still, let me ask that real clear. Do you think that flying as such, and of course, since this is also a logistics channel, that's not only regarding passengers flying from Hamburg to Stuttgart, for instance, or from Frankfurt to New York, but obviously also cargo, because a lot of cargo is transported in each and every airplane. So what's your thought on flying and on transportation by air?
I'm well aware from a logistics point of view. Of course, there is one other aspect, and that is time. Yeah, and of course, in this podcast, I don't have to focus on that. Flying is by far the fastest way of getting things from A to B. It has its limitations with regard to masses, but the question is, here we're talking more about how much do we actually have to fly around, and can we have smarter ways to transport our goods? I mean, this is certainly not something, or you could easily do a complete podcast on that. I sometimes think that we have to look at the ratio between payload and packaging. I don't know the exact numbers, and certainly in aircraft, these are hopefully better. And the payloads are usually be of more value with regard to the weight, the mass that they have. But I sometimes look at other things and I say this could be done smarter. And I'll give you one example. I mean, that has nothing to do with flying. I'm back at the port now, and I'm back at, let's say, fabrics or like shirts that are produced in Indonesia or in Philippines or China. And then they come on a large cargo ship to Hamburg. And the situation that I have looked into is that a single shirt is wrapped in a plastic bag, and then there are 20 shirts, each wrapped in a plastic bag in a box. And then 20 boxes are put in a larger box, and then 20 of these larger boxes are put on a pallet, and then 20 of these pallets are put on a truck, and then the truck goes somewhere. And some people think that it's the most ecological way to put the whole truck on a train and then let the train drive the truck through the countryside. And I think, oh my God, have they ever considered how much is actually payload? We're talking about the shirts, and how much is packaging and means of transportation in order to get a shirt from A to B. And myself being an IT guy, I know that there are much, much better ways. There are much smarter ways of transporting goods these days. And sometimes I have the impression we are still using the technologies from 20, 30, 40 years ago, because we've always done that.
Right.
And then we kind of incrementally try to improve every single step in the process chain, every single... when I say we have to think mobility differently, this includes the way of how mobility actually would change much more drastically. And I mean, having a professional background also in a very, very large organization for many years, where I've been working in Germany and abroad in different seat positions, I know how difficult it is to change processes and procedures in larger organizations. But with regard to transportation and mobility, no matter how hard it is, it has to be done. And we better start thinking about these things today and not let them stay like they have always been for the next generation. This won't work.
And still let us haunt us each and every day, wherever we're working with. So indeed, Klaus, that's a fantastic finishing sentence, actually right on the minute. First of all, I wanted to say thank you, a very big thank you again for taking your time and for sharing this amazing information concepts today. Also want to thank the audience for joining us and for sharing the time with us as well. Now, Klaus, if somebody is listening, or also later on when this show is on Spotify, and there is somebody listening and thinking, oh wow, that's just amazing, how can they reach you if there's somebody that wants to learn more?
First of all, yes, I'll share that with you. Thank you, Christoph, for having me, and I thank everyone who listened. I mean, you saw me, but I couldn't see you. And what I want to say is have a good evening, a wonderful afternoon, or even a wonderful rest of the morning, depending on where you currently are. I'm in Germany. The background that you see here, which is in Hawaii, that's fake. So I'm not in Hawaii right now. it was on one of the slides. I don't know whether you will make this particular slide available to the crowd. You find me on LinkedIn. My name is Klaus Radermacher, and if you just take the name, you will find me on LinkedIn. There are three or four people with that name, but I'm in the Cologne area in Bad Honnef in Germany on the Rhine Valley. That's where you find me. Also, if you Google my name and put in mobility, you come to quite some different either articles or reports or interviews on the web, especially a lot is in German, but the study that I talked about, the survey that I did, this is available in English as well, and you'll find it on my webpage. My company's name is KRBE, like Klaus Radermacher, my initials, and Business Excellence, the BE, KRBE, and then .gmbh. It's not .de, it's not .com, it's GmbH, which is the German abbreviation for a limited liability company. So there you find more information about me. Yes, if you share that, So far, everybody who wanted to get in touch with me has been successful in doing so. And if you contact me via LinkedIn or via email, Klaus Radermacher in one word, Klaus with a K, Radermacher has three R's at the beginning, in the middle, at the end, and then at gmail.com. That's easy as well. You find this contact information on the last slide. And if you share that, Christoph, with everyone who participated in this podcast, I'll be happy to hear from you. And I promise I will get back to you. But believe me, I'm quite busy right now. And it's a small company. It's myself. And I have a couple of projects and things to write right now. It may be a little while, but I will get back to you, I promise.
Fantastic. And I just shared also the link of Klaus' homepage right here in the comment section. So you can just copy it there. And with that being said, once again, I want to thank each and everybody for being on the show. And I wouldn't be surprised if we see Klaus another time right here on the 12 Logistics. So once again, thank you, everybody, for your time. And see you next time again.
Thank you. Have a wonderful day or evening.